there are constraints on how big they could be. So, upper limits on neutrino masses. There's several different kinds. There's cosmology. Cosmology basically says that neutrinos, you know, they have an abundance. We know everything there is to know about neutrinos, kind of. But they participate in weak reactions, so we know that they're in equilibrium with things in cosmology. Then we know the abundance of other things in cosmology, like photons. And so you can calculate the abundance of neutrinos, so you know how many of them there are around us, and there's a lot. And so given that, if their mass is too large, they're actually going to dominate the universe. And so by having that not happen, you can get a constraint on neutrino masses. And I forget what the value is, but it's less than, you know, few-ish electron volts. Just to give you an idea how they compare. Or else. Sorry? These are the ones that take part in that. So that's an important point, is that because there were scenarios where we had sterile neutrinos out the years. These are constraints on the ones for which the interactions are sufficiently strong that they are in thermal equilibrium with things in the early universe. So, if they have a mass, then the propagation aggregates are none of electron, muon, or tau. But these, so then if you went through all the neutrinos right there, what we know is that three of them participate in weak interactions fairly significantly. And then the fact that you, for instance, that the solar neutrinos see the missing electron neutrino flux in the muon and tau neutrinos says that there's all the other ones beyond those three tend to not contribute strongly to the weak interactions. And so there'll be bounds on those from cosmology, depending on how strongly they couple. It'll depend, the abundances, how well you know the abundance will depend on how well you know how they couple, and then there'll be model-dependent bounds for them. But for the three that are taking part in weak interactions, basically the sums of their masses have to be less than. It's better than that now. It used to be this, but it's actually just a little bit less than an EV or so. Or else the dominant universe is the few EV one. But the better bound is coming from where they screw up the UCMB. They can't be the dark matter because they're relativistic, and so that doesn't clump right. So there's one set of bounds. There's a. Sorry? Yeah, but those are all in the same category that where they had to be very sterile. So there was a whole bunch of things that weren't participating in weak reactions at all in the first approximation.
Why couldn't that be dark matter?
Oh, you don't know that those are not dark matter. It would depend on what you thought their abundance was. But the what I'm thinking is that these ones you know are there. You know their abundance already because they're in equilibrium. So it's actually very simple to calculate their abundance. And if they had the right mass, they could be the dark matter. Because the dark matter sees the mass density. And so if you know the number density for the right mass, you can make the mass density work too. But that's the bound here that says that you dominate the universe. If you just made it a little bit less than that, you can make them be a big chunk of the universe, and that could be the dark matter. But that fails as a picture of dark matter because it doesn't describe the way galaxies form properly. So that picture doesn't work. But if you manage to make the super heavy ones happen to have the right abundance for whatever reason, it won't be because of the equilibrium with the weak interactions, but you might have some other way of pitching your abundance, and it could be, yeah. There's direct laboratory bounds. So in the old days, when muons, tau, and electron neutrinos were different, you had different bounds for each. And so now the bounds have to be interpreted as on the dominant contribution, the neutrino that dominantly takes part in those decays. But what you do is, for instance, for muons, you know, there's a decay at pi, you know, pi plus, that goes to mu plus, nu mu. That's a two-body decay, and so the spectrum for that, the spectrum for the muon, this is the number of muons against the energy of the muon, is just basically a spike. And the spike is at a specific energy compared to the, determined by the pion mass, because that's the thing that's carrying out that's whose energy is being carried off. If these had the same mass, the spike would have been at half the pion mass, and the rest of the pion. But so it's not exactly half because they don't have the same mass, but it's a specific value, and so it's a known function of the ion mass. And so you go up and you see where these things are, and if they, you know, where the spike is a function of the ion mass, depends on what the mass of this muon is, because if they had the same mass, it would be a path of ion mass, and if it's massless, it's something else. But so by measuring where that spike is, you're getting a measurement of muon mass. And you can kind of get a sense as to what the bound is going to be, because if you do, say, a percent measurement on something like this, the ion mass is the ballpark of 100 MeV, so a percent of that is going to be, you know, a tenth of an MeV or so, and that's kind of more or less where the bound is. If you get limits of something like the tens of keV range coming from those kind of measurements, that's less than sort of that. And then a better one is if you take the things involving electron type neutrinos, basically the best one I think right now is just from tritium and beta decay. And again, you look for the distant number of electrons against the energy of electron. In this case, it's a beta decay, so it's basically a neutron going to proton plus electron plus neutrino, so it's a free body decay. So you get some sort of spectrum. And you're looking for fewer events at the end here. Because, you know, if the electrons carry off the energy, the more electron the energy carries off, the less the neutrino can carry off, and there's a lower limit if the neutrino has a mass of how much energy can carry off, and so you're looking for depression there. And so the absence gives you a bound in the ballpark. And then we already talked about double beta decay. The neutrino is double beta decay. The failure to see that gives you not a direct kinematic bound on the mass, but it relates some combination of the masses that I talked about last time. So in the scenario that you only have three neutrinos and nothing else, so you really break Wepton number, this gives you a bound which is also the ballpark of 1 micron volt. But it depends a little bit on the mixing angles, so it's not exactly a mass. So in the simplest case where there's only three neutrinos, and you just have this dimension 5, so if only three neutrinos with my Reimann masses, so if moving this dimension 5, there's two scenarios. So if you look at mass and you counted the states, there's this constraint. Those constraints for the oscillation say that the difference between the masses relevant for solar neutrinos is smaller than the one for atmospheric neutrinos. But you don't know a priori which ones are which. So there's two scenarios. There's a scenario where you have two neutrinos that are light. So they're split by, you know, this range here would be the mass splitting relevant to solar neutrinos, which is a small one, and then there's a heavier one. Or basically, this would be the mass splitting relevant to atmospheric neutrinos. That's called what you know is that the electron neutrino has a big overlap with these guys, because solar neutrinos, you're seeing electron neutrinos disappear as they come to the Earth. So they have to be taking a big part of this of overlap here. So that electron neutrino has a big overlap. There's somebody in there. And the atmospheric neutrinos could very well be mu tau oscillations where the electron neutrino is not participating very much. And so this scenario where the electron neutrino is one of the two lightest ones, largely, is called the, what's the word? It's normal hierarchy or something like that. Just because, you know, you're expecting the first generation to be the light thing. And then an alternative picture would be, again, if you have mass, you could have the two narrowly spaced states like something like that. So this could be the solar, and this could be the atmospheric splitting. And again, this is, you know, electron neutrino has a big overlap there. This is called the inverted hierarchy. And so when people say that there's a lower limit to neutrino masses, what they mean is that if you switch these things down so that the lightest one is massless, and the top one has a lower limit, which is set by the atmospheric neutrino oscillation, which is something like, you know, n minus 0.5, you know, a little bit less than a tenth of an electron volt. So these kind of things are not so far. This one and the cosmological one are kind of getting down towards the limit of the top here. This top here is going to be something like 0.05 electron volts, or in that ballpark. So we're getting to a point where these measurements could plausibly expect to see something, if they start to see this top one. And what they see depends a little bit on, it's harder to see this than this because there's more things with the bigger mass here. And there's one more thing I wanted to say. Oh, there's also, if you have more than three neutrinos, if there's a light zero neutrino, then you know, you can do more things. You can have a, if you have another state here, you can stick it somewhere. And you can change this pattern. So this does apply, the above need not apply if there exists a light sterile fourth neutrino. And there's one experiment which claims to find evidence for a light fourth neutrino in the sense that there's an oscillation measurement that's done in Los Alamos, the LSND experiment. It claims to see oscillations with a delta M squared, you know, bigger than an electron volt or so. And so there's no way that you can adjust these things, given that these splittings are known and this big splitting is known. There's no way, and given that this whole thing, if you made, given that you have two differences, if you only have three states, you know all the differences, and there's no way, there's no room for a difference to be this large. So if this experiment was right, then you would need a fourth neutrino to describe it at least. But people are skeptical whether it's right. It's kind of marginally compatible with another experiment, which is sensitive to the same energy range. And there's a subsequent experiment that's been done to decisively test it. And it's supposed to be announcing its results every year for the last little while. And it hasn't been, so they're still sorting out their errors. But so we'll soon enough know if that's right. But if you had to bet money, I'd bet against that.
So how does this actually being seen in the first place? Do they just see the disappearance of neutrinos at this point?
Yeah, if I remember right, they have a big tank of mineral oil, which is a detector, and then they in Los Alamos, they make a beam of pions, and the pions decay to muons and neutrinos, and so they have a known mixture of muon and micron neutrinos, and then they look for seeing reactions where you're seeing electrons. And the claim is that the muon neutrinos are would be, it's a disappearance experiment basically. They're seeing that fewer things than they expected to get, if I remember right. But that's more or less, they made a neutrino beam and they've got a tank of mineral oil which sees electron neutrinos. And the thing is that their energies and the distance between the production and the detector is such that, you know, in the oscillation you're sensitive to the combination delta M squared, you know, L over E, right? Where L is the distance you go and E is the energy. And so the delta M squared you're seeing is set by the energy and the distance that's over which the oscillation takes place. And for them it happens that this combination is much different than it was for the solar and atmospheric neutrinos. So that's why the delta M squared is so much larger.
Isn't this also at the same time experiment on beta 1-3?
So, I forget now if that's. You're wondering if they needed to have theta 1-3. I think if this experiment is true, it has information with theta 1-3, but you can't explain this experiment with theta 1-3 because you can't get the delta M squared to work. Theta 1-3 is to do with. You can largely think of this thing I've been saying as being two separate. Two level oscillations, and theta 1-3 is the thing that screws it up a little bit. And so the information with theta 1-3 is coming both from these where they see oscillations. And even if there's no value of theta 1-3 which could account for this experiment, because the delta M squares are off, if there's only three neutrinos. So if you have more than three neutrinos, then even more than theta 1-3, you've got a full effect four matrix of mixing the angles. So And it's true that the people have, so people have taken this experiment seriously, and they've asked if you had four neutrinos, can you fit that experiment and also fit these other experiments? And it's never a very convincing fit. It's not like you get a really spectacularly good fit. So that's one of the reasons why people are skeptical of that experiment. And there's another experiment called Kármán, I think, which comes very close to ruling this out. They don't have exactly the same delta m squared mean, so that there's a small range of parameters where you could see something here and not see something in this other experiment, but it's very marginal. But these experiments are always hard, you know, because you're cutting a lot of events. So it's, you know, the whole solo neutrino story was a long period where people for, you know, 20 years were talking about the solo neutrino experiments as if they were also marginal and you can't really trust them. So it takes a while. But what will convince people will be have more than one group do this and see if that's why they do the other experiments to test it. Because you never know, there's not a systematic error you're missing. I think that's all I want to say about neutrino masses, unless there's something you want to ask.
I wanted to ask a question about the idea is that now that there's a mass associated with it, they can be right-handed.
Well, the issue about right-handedness is that issue about the, you know, this. So once they have a mass, there was always a right-handed neutrino, but in the standard model, that was a right-handed anti-neutrino. Because if you had a left-handed neutrino, the antiparticle is always a right-handed anti-neutrino. And so once you have a mass, the issue is the right-handed. Once you have a mass, if you have a left-handed neutrino, a Lorentz transformation will give you a right-handed anti-neutrino, or a right-handed neutrino, because helicity is not a good quantum number if you have a mass. Because helicity is, you know, angular momentum dot momentum, but you can always change the sign of momentum by doing the boost. So then, you know, in this, you've got a, if you have a new bar, if you have a plus a half state here, given a mass, you have a minus a half state. And if you had a minus a half state here, given a mass, you would always have a plus a half state. The question is, are these the same states? So is this really this list the same as this list, or are they distinct states? And if you had no mass, then the helicity alone was enough to distinguish them, because they differed in the sign here. But with a mass, you know, that state and that state, there's nothing. Unless lepton number is a good symmetry, these could be the same state or not, depending on whether. If lepton number is not a symmetry, then there's no conserved thing which distinguishes those states. So they may be different, they may be the same, but maybe that's an experimental issue. And the same thing for those two. So in a scenario where you only have three neutrinos, then what you're saying is that they are the same. So you're saying that there's the three neutrinos we know about. There's now the three states that we had to have by Lorentz invariant that were right-handed. But those are the ones we were thinking of as the neutrinos anyway, so they're not new states beyond what we had before. So that would be the scenario where this column and this column are the same column. But once you start adding external neutrinos, then you have an option where you could be, you're adding more columns like this. Then whether those are independent neutrinos, which are again identical to their antiparticles, or if those are paired off with the known neutrinos in a way which preserves the lepton number, is another, again, experimental question. So you can imagine a world where where one of these stereo neutrinos carries, L mu minus L tau is a symmetry of the stereo neutrino too. So that means one combination of our neutrinos would pair off with an anti neutrino, with the stereo neutrino, and would make a Dirac neutrino, which carries a definite value of this charge. And that would be a neutrino for which the particle and the antiparticle are different. So that would mean that at low energies you're seeing four states, and so in things like double beta decay, the experiments like double beta decay are the ones that would kind of can distinguish those options, because a Dirac neutrino, one that carries the charge, doesn't contribute to double beta decay at all, because that involves violating lepton number. But the number it violates isn't mu minus tau, so like this particular thing is one that you can live with. If this is an exact symmetry, you could not describe atmospheric neutrinos in terms of mu tau oscillations, but you would have the oscillations involving the spheral thing involved. So you can still get into that. As far as I know, this symmetry could be an exact symmetry in nature, and there's no because no one's done an oscillation experiment with a tau neutrino, I think as it stands, you could live with that as a symmetry of nature. It has no anomalies, it turns out. There's a lot of nice things about that symmetry. I'm not completely sure if that's right, but it's, I think that's right. Any other questions about the neutrinos? Yeah. Oh. Okay, stretching. So then there's an issue of what we cover in the last chapter on beyond the camera model. One of the things you're interested in for the LHC is, you know, what's the worst case scenario is that you find the standard model is literally true in detail. So this, the Higgs is there, it's got exactly the properties it's supposed to have. You learn a lot about the vacuum in that case, but then we're basically in the same boat we are now where we believe the standard model is true, but the next tests of it are so far in the future that I retire first, so I personally won't care. But so you'd like to know what are the odds that the standard model is right? And if there's something beyond the standard model, it's likely to be beyond it. And a natural way to approach that, you know, that discussion bifurcates along the lines of, if you think of energies and what the states are available to us, you know, we have things like the top quark, and we've got the Z boson and the W boson and so on, and the bottom quark. If there's things beyond the standard model, that's going to have to involve new particles. And so the choice is the new particles could all, say this is the energies above here, you know, the LHC cannot reach. So these are the ones that are experimentally accessible. Accessible. The two choices are these new particles, they could all be very heavy, and that's why we haven't seen them. Or some of them could be very light, but we might still not see them if they were weakly interacting with the particles we do have. You know, like a neutrino. If you didn't know the neutrinos were supposed to be there, there's a lot of ways in which you could have missed them. And so the choice as to what you expect depends on whether or not all are all. New particles heavier than the known ones. And part of that choice is really the Higgs particle, because we haven't seen it yet. You could choose the Higgs particle, and you can imagine the Higgs particle in the standard model is supposed to be light, because that makes the best agreement with the radiative correction. If you plot the predictions for the W mass, if you measure the Fermi constant, the fine structure constant, and the muon lifetime, W mass and Z mass. Those three things are very well measured, and in terms of them, you can predict W mass in the standard model, but it depends. Also, at the classical level we've been working, there's a formula for the W mass in terms of these three things. But if you work to higher and higher accuracy where corrections, perturbative corrections are important, this starts to be sensitive to things like the Higgs mass and other things. And so if you plot, you know, the experimental value, so it's around 80, and this is the experimental range, and you compare it to the theoretical prediction, the theoretical prediction is a function of the I'm plotting here is the W mass down here. That's the experimental measurement. But the prediction depends on the Higgs mass through these radiative corrections, but only weakly, logarithmically. And there's a theoretical prediction which goes something like this. This is the theory. And it's got a width because it depends on the value of the strong coupling, and it depends on the value of the top mass, and there's errors in those things. So that's why you get something like that. But you kind of see that the agreement happens for light values of the Higgs mass. So theoretically, in the standard model, you're expecting the Higgs mass to be light. Although when I say this, one of the things you should be aware of is that it's typically true that if you do a comparison like this involving leptons, the W boson, or things not involving strongly interacting particles, you get pointed towards the light Higgs. If you ask for observables that involve hadrons, you sometimes get pointed towards heavy Higgs. And there's kind of a bit of a tension in the data, which is not statistically significant yet, but it's a tension which makes it look like the leptonic observables favor light Higgs and the quark-related observables favor heavy Higgs. And if that's true, that's a sign that the standard model is not quite getting it right. If that were to be borne out by these experiments, that's a hint that there's of what might the pattern be that's replacing the standard model. But right now, the best inferences about the Higgs mass are that it's light, the standard model. And so your choices for it, since it hasn't been discovered yet, are it's light or it's heavy. And that separates how you should think about physics beyond the standard model. So this is the main question, and a subversion, you know, a subset of this question is the Higgs itself light? And you can imagine that in the case that the Higgs is heavy, or that the other particles are light, you've got much more play. You've got much more potential for experimentally seeing them, because the degrees of freedom, you're either missing something in the standard model, so the standard model itself is going to go wonky on you, which it does at energies kind of right around here, if this is the LHC limit. Or if you've got other light things, you've been trying to produce those light things in the experiments, and so that's a good way to check it. The case which is the kind of the hardest case is if the Higgs is in here somewhere in light, and all the other particles are heavy, and that's the one that looked the most like the standard model. As if you make those particles all heavier, heavier, and heavier, it's going to look more and more and more like the standard model. And you can say a lot about that case, because that's the case that's described by an effective field theory involving, you know, we wrote down the most general normalizable things involving standard model fields, and we should include all the standard model fields if the Higgs is really down here somewhere. But we didn't write down non-normalizable things until we started talking about neutrinos. And once we started talking about neutrinos, we recognized that the first non-normalizable thing to write down actually does a really good job of describing the one thing that we know is not described by the standard model. So I want to examine this under the scenario that so I'm going to take the point of view that this is a yes, and this is also a yes. So that's an explicit choice I'm making. It's a defensible choice, but it's a choice. So that, you know, one of the points of the LHC is to decide what the options were in those two questions. So if yes to both, then the particles we keep are the ones in the standard model, so we know what the fields are for those, and we know what the symmetries are. And the particles we don't keep are all the ones that are heavy, and we assume them to be very heavy, so it should make sense to expand things in powers of inverse powers of mass. Then we can integrate out heavy ones, heavy new particles. And describe their effects at low energies. In terms of an effective field theory involving standard model particles. So in that case, we'd expect the effective Lagrangian to be sum of all possible interactions, which is consistent with the gauge invariance of the standard model, but we do not require that it be renormalizable. So we step back from that, and we organize all the terms that could be there according to how many powers of this heavy mass, how many powers of inverse masses they have in coupling constants, thinking that those inverse masses are very big masses, and so that the more inverse powers of mass you have, the smaller the effects are. So it's useful to then organize what are the things you can write down in increasing dimension. So what I want to do is I want to write this as a sum over interactions of something involving the standard model fields, you know, the leptons and the Higgs and everything else. And each of these things is built out of the fields and the derivatives and has some dimension. We're organizing them in increasing dimension, and then the coefficients are going to have involved more and more powers of 1 over m. So if you start this off, the lowest dimension thing you can write here is 1. So that's like C0. That's dimension, that's called dimension 4 because, no, that's, I lied to you. That's called dimension 0 because, you know, the operator I've used here is the unit operator. It has no dimensions. The next lowest dimension we can write down is the Higgs term that we had in the standard model. We had the, we had a term like mu squared h star h. It was actually, there's some numerical coefficient here, which I don't care about so much. This is dimension 2, because you count dimension ignoring the coupling constant here. So that there's two fields here. Each boson has dimensions of mass, and this is counting powers of mass. Then at dimension 4, we have basically the rest of the standard model. So all the things with dimensionless coupling constants, that's all the kinetic terms, all the gauge interactions, all the quartic interactions of the Higgs fields. So basically, if we stopped here, we'd have the standard model. And these two things are just the choices we made in the scalar potential. We had a constant term, which we chose to be 0. We had a, you know, when we write V is lambda over 4 h dagger h minus b squared squared, if you expand that in powers of h, the thing involving the constant, we've said that C naught is equal to V to the 4th lambda over 4. And then C, this term mu squared, we're just saying is the cross term here of mu of V squared 2, or it's, I guess it's lambda v squared over 2. And we've made a relationship between those two things because we've designed this thing so that the v, this potential is minimized when h is equal to v, and that at that minimum, capital V is 0. So we've designed it so that C0, we didn't design it so C0 was 0. We designed it so that the potential was 0 at its minimum. And then the h dagger h squared term is one of the terms that was in the standard model, four-dimensional, you know, dimensionless couplings story. So this is a renormalizable part that we've talked about till now. That is the standard model. And then at dimension 5, we had one term. We had L gamma left L HH with some coefficient which was, you know, let's call it C5. And this is C5 goes like 1 over some big mass. Let's see, let's come back to that in a second. This was unique. And the great news was that it could have been there, and it seems like it is there. It's the one thing you can't have at that point is the one thing that was seen. That's giving us neutrino masses. And this all points to an M, which was something like 10 to the 15 GeV or 10 to the 13 GeV, depending on what the dimensionless couplings were. And that was coming from the requirement that the neutrino masses were sufficiently light. But that depends on the detail of the numerical factors, dimensionless factors in C5. And then in dimension 6, there were lots of things you could have. So for example, you could have anything in the standard model dimension 4. Let's call this not standard model, let's call it L4. L4 times Higgs dagger Higgs is dimension 6, say. So you could hold, wrap things like that right there. And then there's other things like, you could have things like you have quark, up quark, or gamma mu nu, up quark, Higgs, things like that look like a, let's mention, oh, I'm missing something there. That has dimensions, that's gauge field. So there's a, and a gauge generator in here. I'm going to do this. So F mu nu contracts with gamma mu nu, and then there's a gauge index which contracts with some gauge index there, TA. There's a whole class of things like that, and there's other things as well. I'll say a whole bunch of those things. So there's a whole raft of these, raft of dimension 6, whose coefficients should go like 1 over m squared, if these go like 1 over m, if m is a scale. Particles of mass m. much bigger than the weak scale. And so on. You keep on working your way down the list. And this is a good example of something. You know, if you had a term in here, which was where the coefficient was 1 over the weak scale to the fourth, or the weak scale squared, the weak scale whatever, unless it violates, it's going to be very hard to distinguish between the weak interactions themselves, which you get by trading W and Z bosons. And so in terms of the low energy fermions, this is described by an operator which feels like 1 over the weak scale to the fourth. Unless these things violate a selection rule of the things in the standard model, they're going to be very hard to see. And so that was satisfied here. This had this accidental selection rule where the lepton number was conserved, and this violated it, so it was not competing with anything you saw here. So even though this gives small effects, those small effects are visible because they're something which is not competing with anything else. So the fact you've got a very small mass in the denominator is stable. If you imagine doing loop corrections to it, you don't grow. You might have thought the smallest mass would win in the denominator. That's generically true. But if the symmetry of lepton number is only broken at very high energies, then whatever the physics is that corrects this, it has to involve very high energy particles. That'll always bring in a 1 over a very heavy mass, so that it's consistent to think of this thing having a coefficient which is 1 over a large mass scale, precisely because it's violating a symmetry which the low energy part of the theory doesn't satisfy. And so it's a very self-consistent picture. If this is the mass scale relevant, these things are kind of very hard to see unless they also violate a symmetry which is preserved by all this stuff. And so there are things like that. Variant number is one. CP conservation is another one. So when you're looking at that list, you're normally thinking not about the generic list. You're thinking mostly about those terms there that break symmetries that are preserved by the standard model. And these are notable ones, because these are preserved by the standard model, either both the very, very, very good approximations. And they may be broken by this term, but you know, variant number certainly isn't broken by this term, but CP might be, depending on what these C's are doing. But CP violation in the neutrino sector needn't give you big effects if you're following CP violation experimentally in some other sector involving quarks, let's say. So there's a class of operators here which are the ones that people normally look at, and they're looking at them because they're the things that you can distinguish from the things that are in the standard model. And so the one, if we get to it, that I would talk about are the variant number ones. And then the list is not so long. So now, what's your prejudice of what you should expect? Is that if the low energy particles in the effective field theory are weakly interacting, and they are standard model at high energies, which if you're interested in energies which are kind of up here, where the strong interactions are also weakly interacting, because the strong interactions are strong, but the strong down here, then all the interactions in the standard model are weakly coupled. And so it's a self-consistent picture to think that everything is weakly interacting. And then in that kind of a framework, the size in which these coefficients is set by some scale related to these masses. There's an assumption I'm making that so if the physics you don't know about, the heavy things you integrate out, if they're strongly interacting, you can worry that the scales that you get in this, when you calculate these effective interactions, the scales you get may not be simply related to the masses of the states that you get at high energies. And that's so for example, if you had supposing that the physics at high energies was the QCD all over again, a copy of the QCD that we already know about. In QCD, we know that the fields in the problem were the quarks, and the lightest ones of those were at the MeV, you know, the up quark and the down quark have masses of the order of an MeV. But the lightest actual particle you get is the pion, which is a 100 MeV. And that's because the state that's the mass eigenstate is not simply related to the field that we're talking about, because of the strong interactions bound the fields, the elementary fields, into a bound state. That could happen at higher energies. And so when we talk about this mass, I'm going to mean the mass of the states that are there, which is going to effectively mean the mass of the, since we haven't produced those states, you can't actually go out and measure the mass of the particles that have been produced, but we're going to just mean the mass in front of these operators. But once we've got that mass by integrating out the heavy physics, if we ask how that has changed by the light interactions in this part of the theory, then those are weakly interacting. So they don't get changed in the fourth way in the energies that we're interested in. And so the bottom line is that what we're expecting is at low energies on dimensional grounds, you should expect to get whatever the mass was we integrated out in the appropriate power on dimensional analysis here. So, and the expectation, I should say generic maybe expectation. Is that we should find that C0 is on the order of m to the fourth, you know, mu squared should be on the order of m squared, C5 should be on the order of 1 over m, 6, dimension 6 is actually 1 over m squared, and so on. And here m is the scale relevant to these heavy states, whatever they are, the new physics. And it's, you know, that's kind of fairly vague. If you actually produce those particles, you could ask how are they related to those masses of the particles you produced. And then there's going to be issues of coupling constants. But all I'm going to worry about is just dimensional grounds thing. So I'm not worrying about factors of 100 here. I'm worried about factors of 10 to the 15. And so you can kind of see that this is great. This is great. We understand why those things are small. But these are a problem. Because if you think of the standard model as being a generic thing you got at low energies given some heavier stuff, then a lot of the standard model makes a lot of sense. All the stuff in here, you know, you understand, you know, almost everything in the standard model, you understand why it could have the size it could have, and there's no reason why heavy physics should complicate what you see. But your prejudice as to the size of the dimensional parameters in the model, that one and that one, is that they should be enormous. And the biggest, because it's positive powers of mass, it's the biggest mass that wins. So that if you generate them with enormous coefficients, the further corrections you get by integrating out standard model particles are going to be also of order the mass of those particles to the fourth or the squared. But those are smaller anyway, so that those are small corrections for these ones. So there's a generic problem here that the problem is that we know experiment requires mu should be in the ballpark of 100 GeV, because we know that V is 246 GeV from the measurement of the Fermi constant. So if m is much bigger than that, there's a question as to there's something wrong with the picture of the standard model just being a generic low energy residue of what you get at higher energies. And also, the corresponding thing for C0 is something. It didn't depend on any of the standard model fields at all, so you might think you can't test it. But that's because we haven't turned on gravity. If you turn on gravity, then there's a root g in front of everything here, so that the metric sees everything, and the metric couples to all things and couples to C0 in particular. So if you interpret this as a cosmological constant, it would be, if you interpret the value of the potential at the minimum to be a cosmological constant, then you can see that if this was a generic number and wasn't adjusted to make the minimum zero like it was here, and the generic size, if this is much bigger than all the other terms, then the generic size you expect for the potential at the minimum would be m to the fourth. But the cosmologic constant has been measured to be something like 10 to the minus 3 electron volts to the fourth power. And so in both those cases, there's a problem, right? So why are these things so small? This is something where if all you had were the standard model particles, then this would be actually not such a bad thing, right? Because this is comparable to the biggest masses we have in the standard model. There's dimensionless couplings which can give us factors of 10 or 100, because alpha is 1 over 100. So whether you think this is a problem depends on how big you think m is. But if you think m is actually very close to the weak scale, this isn't such a big problem. But this is a problem regardless of what you think m is, because we know that m, you know, in this whole scenario, can't be smaller than the weak scale. But even if you take the weak scale particle size, standard model particles would contribute, if they contribute at this size, they're contributing way too much. Because every particle in the problem, except for the neutrinos and the photon, have a mass which is way bigger than that. So So this is a problem. The question as to why this is small compared to all the other particles you know about is the cosmological constant problem. And that one, you have to, if the standard model is all there is, it's still a problem, because the particles in the standard model would contribute too large an amount to this. As you integrate them out to get effective theories at lower and lower energies, down to the energies where you measure this, which is in cosmology at very, very small energies, you would get enormous contributions from the particles we see. This is a problem if you believe that there's physics much higher scales than weak scale. And we have reason to believe that, right? We have evidence for it here in the trio masses. And we have other evidence for it in the existence of gravity. Gravity points to, you know, G Newton, and the units we're using is 1 over scales mass squared, and that mass is 10 to the 10 GeV, 10 to the 19th GeV. And so this scale and this scale both point to the existence of physics at energies enormous compared to the standard model scales. And so if you think there is physics out there at those scales, then you have a problem here. So if there are particles with m, you know, much bigger than 100 GeV, then the smallness of mu is a problem that's called the hierarchy problem. This is a little right here somewhere. But because it involves, the problem is to do with physics between the weak scale and whatever you think the physics is that's relevant. You can fix that problem by changing what you think is going on up there. And so there's many proposals as to what you could do there. And I'm going to outline, you know, a couple of them. But none of them really convincingly addresses this, because the problem here is really that this scale is really small compared to weak scale, and so why should that be possible? So I want to focus, I want to zoom in on the hierarchy problem. So approaches, so since the hierarchy problem is only really a problem if m is much bigger than m weak for some particle, it can be addressed modifying the standard model, but only at high energies. Which is the framework we're involved in here. And so there's basically three logical approaches. So it's three lines of, three categories of approach. So the most conservative one is what's worked in the past, right? The problem is to do with this particular interaction, which involves the scalar field, the Higgs field. So the assumption is that if the energy level diagram of the world was all the standard model stuff, standard model particles, the top was it, W, and then there's all the heavy particles, let's say this M is 10 to the 10 or GeV or higher, it's a very large mass scale like that one or that one, then the problem is if you write the effective field theory in this region, you've integrated all the heavy stuff, you've got this stuff over here, and your problem now depends on this Higgs field, and you're getting a big answer. But it made sense when you wrote the theory down at this scale here to include the Higgs field. So, you know, if the Higgs field didn't exist, if the Higgs field was a composite thing made of some microscopic substructure, then let's say that the Higgs was composite at some scale like this. Let's say the Higgs and possibly other particles composite. The binding energy and lambda are not. So this, the scale of binding, say it would be like the confinement scale or whatever you like, lambda of the order of much bigger than the weak interaction, say. So it's greater than the order of lambda weak. But what I want to say is this is much less than the scale of the physics M. So let's say that's the scale here. And as you integrate up the heavy stuff, the effective theory you're writing down here doesn't have a Higgs effect. So you can't write that dangerous term down. And so you'll get something involving the substructure fields, whatever they are, the new quarks or whatever they were. And then and as long as they have the quantum numbers that you can't write down something with dimension two, and as long as all you need, it's only scalars that can appear in dimension two. If we had fermions, you had to have at least dimension three, right? But then for fermions, it was actually, you could forbid masses using symmetries if we did the standard model. So the scalars are dangerous here because there's no symmetry at all that can forbid this term. If you have something transforming under any symmetry at all, any internal symmetry, like we've been talking about SQ plus C1, this is always invariant, that combination. So scalars are dangerous. And so if there's no elementary scalars in this region, there will be no dimension two operator to worry about. And when you get down to the first place where you have the effective theory with the Higgs in it, because now it's bound, and you integrated all the stuff to do with how it's built, its substructure, then you're at lower energies, and the scale that will appear in mu will be lambda. And so as long as lambda is not so much bigger than the weak scale, you might hope to make it work. So these are the composite models. That kind of points you towards a picture where you shouldn't be thinking of the Higgs as being a low energy theory, depending on exactly now the details of the specific Higgs scalar, how heavy it is compared to the weak scale. A second way to go is to say, well, the only evidence that there's really scales much bigger than the weak scale is indirect. You don't really know in neutrino masses that you've seen a mass that large. You've seen small masses, and you're saying that if this is the description of those small masses, you're being pointed to masses that are very large because you're seeing really small masses. So maybe that's wrong. Maybe there's some sort of a way of violating Lepton number which gives you, maybe you've got a whole bunch of stereo neutrinos which you really like, and there's no heavy particles around. Now you can make models of neutrinos which don't rely on having heavy masses. They're not so pretty, but they exist. And so you might say, well, this is actually a fishy argument that scale is really that large. So then you say, well, the only other evidence for big masses is this one. How do you know that's also indirect? All you really know is that you've got some effective coupling constant that's small. And the weak interactions, you knew that there's a similar story, that the Fermi constant was basically of the order of alpha divided by the MW squared. And so whereas the value of the Fermi constant is the analog of the value of the Planck mass, that points to the scale B. You know, G Fermi is also 1 over V squared up to factors of 2. So the scale you're pointed to with V is the 246 GeV scale, right? Then the bed of the Higgs. But we know that the W mass is actually is lighter than that. It's not 246 GeV, it's 80 GeV. And the difference is because of these dimensionless factors of alpha. You might ask, is there a way you could have a very, very small dimensionless factor which could make G Newton very small without having a very, very large mass scale involved? You know, the picture here was that you got this coupling because you exchanged some W particle, which is very massive. And because this was massive, the effective interaction you got, that was approximately at low energies, like a four Fermi interaction with some coupling G. And that was a weak interaction because this was a heavy particle. The implicit assumption you make here when you say that this is a large mass is you're saying, well, what you're really saying is that, you know, we know that Newton's constant is small, and we're thinking that if we thought of that as the exchange of very heavy particles, those particles would have to be really heavy to make Newton's constant sufficiently small. But there's a loophole because you could have dimensionless factors which are maybe making it small. And it turns out, so until recently, people didn't know how to make this actually work in detail. But it can happen in extra-dimensional models that you could have dimensionless factors. So in extra-dimensional models, dimensions, so if you have d extra dimensions, of radius r, generically Newton's constant in four dimensions is given by the analog of Newton's constant in the extra dimensions, 1 over root squared, times a power of the extra dimensions say 1 over the power of the x dimensions, well, radius times that scale to the d. So you can see that if the x dimension is sufficiently large compared to the basic scale of physics in the x dimensions, you can make this dimensionless factor very small without having m be large. And so it wasn't possible until about 10 years ago to make m as small as the weak scale, but it turns out that you can actually have this work where this is as small as the weak scale if r is large enough. So these extra dimensional models are kind of the existence proof that you might be too naive to say that you know there's a scale of physics at very high energies because you know these constants are small. So that's one way to go. And then the third option would be to say, well, the Higgs is elementary. Or it's at least elementary to scales lambda, which are enormous compared to the weak scale. At least up to lambda much bigger than the weak. And but there really are particles with masses much bigger than weak, which is what this negates. Then you're stuck with it. You've got a range of scales. Here's m weak. And when we integrate out this heavy physics at this point here, scale lambda, let's say, there is a Higgs particle, and so that thing is allowed by all the internal symmetries you know about. And so we would seem to have problems with that. But the question then becomes, is there any possible symmetry you can actually have which could forbid you having this kind of an interaction? And I've already argued that no internal symmetry can. If you have this thing multiplying by some unitary matrix times itself, it's always going to be invariant. This is invariant. But there is a symmetry, it turns out, which can make that small. So, when you postulate a symmetry which can suppress mu squared dagger h. And that's the supersymmetry way to go. So supersymmetry. The only known symmetry, there's two symmetries which could make that small. Scale invariance would make that small. Scale invariance would say that everything of any dimensions at all is small. But the problem with scale invariance is that we know that particles have masses. So we know that we're going to have to break scale invariance, and the biggest mass in the problem will be the strongest breaking. And our assumption is that we've got particles that are extremely heavy which are breaking the scale invariance. So no one knows how to make scale invariance turn into a way of suppressing this term, given that you have to break it a lot in the higher dimensional theory. Not higher dimensional, in the high energy theory. But supersymmetry is a symmetry which could be spontaneously broken at the weak scale, and it would naturally suppress this contribution because supersymmetry relates. It's a symmetry which doesn't just act on the Higgs by itself. It relates the Higgs particle to spin a half particles. And if the symmetry is a good symmetry, the mass of the Higgs is related to the mass of the spin a half particles. But the spin a half particles, we can arrange for their masses to be small because we did that in the standard model. So it relates H fermions, in particular spin a half fermions. And so these are the masses of these fermions can be suppressed using ordinary symmetries by the standard model symmetries. Yeah, so just drives you one here. So those are the options. And they exhaust all the possibilities, right? The effective theory between here and here, either there's a scale like that or not. If not, that's this option. If that scale exists, then either the Higgs is in the effective theory in between or not. If it is, then that's this option. If not, that's this option. And so they kind of are mutually exclusive. And I think if you took a poll, most people in the field are sympathetic to this as being the most probable approach. But these other two options haven't been ruled out yet. And then the beauty of it is that they all three options have experimental implications for the LHC. So that the LHC is supposed to, besides understanding the Higgs mechanism, it's supposed to actually tell us which of these three options is right. So let me talk a little bit about the options. Oh, but before I do, I should say there's one more piece of evidence for high energy that actually I should have said that first. Well, let me, I can't actually say that, but this is not going to say something else first. So I'm going to say mostly, I won't talk about these options in any detail. And I'm just going to talk about this because it's the one that is the best explored. So this is a slide on supersymmetry. And the idea is, is that there's a symmetry which relates bosons to fermions. So you're looking for a symmetry which relates, say, let's say we have a bunch of scalar fields. And we have a bunch of spin and half fields. These are representing the particles we're talking about. And you want a symmetry which transforms one into another. So we want to have delta phi is equal to something times psi. So what can you say about the psi, the something? There should be a parameter here, I guess, epsilon. Whatever we need here, some generator of a matrix or something, times psi. So this is the parameter. Well, the thing is, we know this is a spinner, and this is a scalar. And until now, we've been thinking of the parameters of symmetries as being not transforming under rotation. So they've also been scalars. These have been numbers, or they've been fields if they had local symmetries. So the idea is that if you want to make a scalar out of a spinner, you need another spinner. And so we'll make this guy a spinner. So the parameter is also a spinner. So you can make this work by doing something like delta phi is epsilon bar gamma left psi, say. That would be an allowed transformation rule if epsilon is a spinner. And then if phi is, one thing I could say here, so to make spins match, require something to be a spinner. But another thing you can say in general is that if we count that if we're going to have a symmetry between bosons and fermions, do we have to have the same number of states of each type? So same number of fermion and boson x states tells us how many of these fields we have of each field. The thing is that each fermion comes with two helicities, right? There's think of this as being a neutrino, if you like. It's a left-handed particle and a right-handed antiparticle. So there's always two states. If it's massless, the particle and antiparticle are distinguishable. If it's massive, then there's a plus a half and a minus half state, but there's always two states here. Whereas a real scalar field only has one state. So for every fermionic field, you're going to need two real fields. So there are two real scalars for each Majorana fermion. You'd need four real scalars for each Dirac fermion. Because for an electron, you've got the two spin states of the electron and then two spin states of the positron. And so you need four scalar states to go with that. So the rule of thumb is you have one complex scalar field for every Majorana fermion. Because that's complex scalar field like two real fields. And so that's, this is complex. If psi is Majorana, this is complex. You know, why didn't I write epsilon bar gamma, or epsilon bar psi, or epsilon bar gamma phi psi? I wrote them together as 1 plus gamma phi. And that's because this is a complex conjugate. This is a complex thing. Its complex conjugate would be the thing with gamma right. And I'm imagining here that phi is a complex field. So phi is not phi star. And then this is a very convenient way to pair them off. The left-handed field is being paired off with a complex scalar. The right-handed field is being paired off with a complex conjugate scalar. And that makes sense because for Majorana field, the left and right-handed parts are complex conjugates of each other. So this is a transformation law we could use, and then if we want to vary the fermion, so let's take the left-hand part, because my Majorana, the right-hand part, will be the complex conjugate. Well, we want to have an epsilon, we want to have a field scale of phi, so how can we make all the indices work? We could do this, I guess, but then on dimensional grounds, before we do this, let's do dimensional analysis. This is a mass. Scalar fields have dimensions of mass. Fermionic fields have dimensions of mass to the 3 halves, remember? Because their kinetic term had to also be dimensionless. So that means that this has dimensions of mass to the minus 1 half. So it's like a square root of a length. So now if I try to do the fermionic one, double psi gamma left, the naive thing to do would be to say, well, we've got epsilon phi gamma left, say. But here the dimensions don't work very well. So here, this is the dimensions of mass to the 3 halves. This is the mass, and this is mass to the minus 1 half. So this thing has dimensions of square root of mass. This is mass to 3 halves, so the dimensions don't work. What we could do is we could stick the mass of the particle in here, and then that would make the dimensions work. But if we don't start off with masses in the problem, we have another option. We could also have something like gamma mu, gamma left, gamma mu, epsilon, partial mu phi. Because another way we can get a power of mass is to take a derivative. So this, both these terms can, in general, can appear. This one generically appears. This is always allowed. And the second one will be there or not, depending on whether or not you have a mass in the problem. But it gives you kind of a flavor as to how these things can be related to each other, you know, how you can make a symmetry which might relate them. So given that you have a symmetry like that, you could ask, well, can I make interactions which are invariant under that symmetry? And so you can. So it's easy to check that the Lagrangian, you know, minus 1/2 psi bar d slash psi minus d mu phi star d mu phi has that symmetry. So effect 2 delta phi is equal to epsilon bar gamma left psi, and delta psi gamma left is gamma left, gamma mu, epsilon, up to factors of 2. There's a factor 2 running around here somewhere. Now you might ask, well, what happens if I do the symmetry twice? The interesting thing is that if you do doing two symmetries, symmetry transformations, it's going to give you something involving two epsilons. If you do epsilon 1 and epsilon 2, you're going to get two epsilons. Each one had the dimensions of a square root of a length. You end up with a transformation which includes, among other things, a translation. Includes things like delta 1, delta 2 on phi, includes things like epsilon 1 bar gamma mu epsilon 2 times d mu phi. And that has the form of a transformation like this. That's what we call a general covariance. That's a translation. So there's a sense in which a supersymmetry transformation is like a square root of a translation. So supersymmetry is more like a space-time symmetry, like Poincaré invariance, than it is like an internal symmetry. And that's why it's able to help you with things like this, where, you know, basically an internal symmetry can't forbid that symmetry from being there. But space-time symmetries can, because space-time symmetries have the property, so supersymmetry, it's really a pain to write supersymmetry, so that's typically written to Susie. Is a space-time symmetry what that means is that if you say that this is invariant, that statement is not that the Lagrangian is invariant. So delta L is not zero. It's equal to something like epsilon bar, it's a derivative of something. It's d mu of something like epsilon bar gamma mu psi or something like that. plus the stuff. So the Lagrangian varying into derivative is okay because the action, which is the integral d4x of the Lagrangian, is invariant. So space-time symmetries are the ones typically for which the Lagrangian is not invariant, but the action is, because the Lagrangian varies into a total derivative. So if you do a translation, for instance, on the Lagrangian, you get something like this. And that's important because that's much more restrictive. You know, if you gave me an invariant Lagrangian, so for an internal symmetry, that's just zero. But if that's true, then L squared is also invariant, and L to the 15th power is invariant, and any function of L is also invariant. So you can, there's a whole bunch of Lagrangians. If you give me an invariant Lagrangian, I can give you 16,000 more just by acting on the Lagrangian you had. But if you have something which is an invariant under a space-time symmetry, an invariant Lagrangian squared is not invariant anymore because this property need not be true for the square of Lagrangian if it's true for the Lagrangian. And so it's much more restrictive being invariant under a space-time symmetry than an internal symmetry, and that's kind of why you make progress on things like the existence of these interactions.
Excuse me. Yeah. Does it have any other implications?
Oh, a whole shitload. Yeah, this whole lecture is about the implications.
Once you want to quantize a theory, which is invariant up to the surface,
yeah,
an exact invariant, does it play any role in quantizing the theory? I had this question from before. Now I.
It depends on what you mean. So if you're interested in, one way you could ask that would be, the question that divides it depends on whether or not we're talking about gravity. So if we're just thinking about quantum field theory on flat space and we're just in scalar fields and spin half fields, then for them Poincaré invariance has this property and supersymmetry has this property, and then the issue there is that. The way you construct the conserved currents in that case, T mu would be the conserved current for space-time transformations, for translations. It's not the formula for that in terms of Lagrangian is not the same one you have for internal symmetries, because when you use Noether's theorem to make a conserved current, there's extra contributions coming from this kind of a thing. And that's also true for supersymmetry. There'll be a conserved supercurrent, which is a spin three halves, vector spinner thing, which is conserved because of the symmetry. And the rule for constructing it will have to take into account these things being there. But they're there. And it's there's no subtleties. There's another subtlety specifically for supersymmetry that I haven't got to yet, but I will get to, in that the I'll come back to it. There's an issue about whether or not if you close, I didn't say what the dot 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 here is. And there's a question as to whether or not a symmetry that there's a. For everything you've seen so far, what normally happens with the symmetry is that you do two of them and you get the same kind of the symmetry back. So if I did two SE2 transformations, I get another SE2 transformation. So once I've made the Lagrangian invariant under SE2 transformations, I don't have to worry about repeating the SE2 transformation and getting something else. And so there's an issue in supersymmetry, depending on how you set it up, it can happen that when you take the commutator of two supersymmetry transformations, you get this kind of thing plus other terms. And the other terms vanish when you use the equation of the motion, but they're not identically zero. And so then there's an issue is if I were to iterate the symmetry transformations over and over again, do I continue to get new conditions? And so until supersymmetry, people, I think, didn't consider transformations like that because the thinking was if you had a symmetry which didn't close, and so it wasn't a group, that's why groups are useful because they're defined to be things that you do two transformations, you do another transformation. And if you had something which was not a group in a symmetry, then if you made the Lagrangian invariant under the transformations, you'd have to then ask for making an invariant under the squares of the transformations and under the cubes of the transformations, and that should be a whole series of new conditions of Lagrangian, which are making it more and more restrictive. Whereas for a group, what happens is you make a symmetry invariant under the transformations, and then you're automatically ensured that it's invariant under all the iterations of the transformations, because that's the property of the group. So for supersymmetry, there's a subtlety because the symmetry don't necessarily close completely, they only close up to equations of motion. And that closing up to equations of motion is the loophole that people didn't know about before, that if you close up to equations of motion, it's possible, you can show that the successive iterations of the symmetry don't give you new conditions, provided that you close up to the equations of motion in the way that supersymmetry does. So there's an issue there, which makes it hard to write Lagrangians down sometimes, but it's not really an issue, a fundamental issue, I don't think. But then if you have gravity, gravity is a theory that in flat space, C is only, it's either constant for translations or it's linear in X for a Lorentz transformation. So if you make this an arbitrary function of x, like a gauge symmetry, then gravity is the gauge field for that. And so that this connection kind of tells you that if you try to make supersymmetry a local function, then you're forced to do gravity. So there's no gauge theory of supersymmetry which is not gravity. And so it's always, so the subtlety there is that if you're going to do a local supersymmetry transformation and think of that as being your symmetry, then you're really forced to be doing supergravity. And the gauge field of the supersymmetry part of it will be a spin 3/2 thing, and its partner is a graviton, always. So there's a set of subtleties to do with that, but it's nothing in addition to what the symmetry would tell us. Let me get to a point where we can stop here. So let me write, because I want to just get to the point where I can write some simple interactions down. So that's the simplest case. Free theories have lots of symmetries, turns out. You know, another example would be if I take Lagrange to be minus 1/2 psi bar b slash psi minus b mu phi star b mu phi minus m over 2 psi bar psi minus m squared phi star phi. That has a symmetry delta phi is equal to epsilon bar gamma left psi delta psi gamma left is gamma mu. Again, up to factors of 2 and root 2. I'm not being careful about factors of numerical factors there. But this symmetry requires that to be the same as m. And so that's making the masses the same. So fermion and bosonic masses are equal. So far, it's still free theory. Well, what about interactions? Well, in general, so if we take a general normalizable theory, so if L is minus 1/2 psi bar p slash psi minus d mu phi star d mu phi, what are the normalizable interactions we could imagine having? We could imagine having a Yukawa coupling, so we could have minus y phi psi bar gamma, let me make sure I do this right here. So psi bar phi star gamma left psi. That's not what's done again. Now we've got V phi. So this is a general normalizable interaction. It's invariant. In fact, why don't we just be more general than this? Let's say it's we'll say minus psi bar gamma left psi times some function of phi star. That's not this time yet. It's invariant if f is dw dphi, and if v is dw dphi squared for any w which is a function of phi only and not phi star. So you hand me any function of w, of phi, I differentiate it once, and then that gives me a Yukawa coupling. And if I differentiate it once and square it, that gives me the potential energy. If the Yukawa couplings and potential energies are related in that way, for any value of phi, then that has a supersymmetry which is like this, where the m here is being played by, so where delta psi left is gamma mu, gamma left epsilon d mu phi plus dw d phi gamma left epsilon. So this would be the special case where w is equal to 1/2 m phi squared. So the w d phi, oh, two derivatives, right? So the w d phi squared is, in that case, m. And then this then becomes that. And the w d phi, in that case, is linear in phi. When I square it, I get that. So this is a special case of that with that choice. If you have w is linear in phi, then it's not very interesting because then the second derivative is zero, so there's no u phi couplings, and the v is just a constant in that case because then the second derivative is a constant if we square it. But as soon as you go past something quadratic in w, then you're starting to get things. So if you add a term like g phi cubed, that gives you a term, that gives you a u phi coupling. Let me write this on the next board. So w is equal to g phi cubed implies that your u phi coupling is f phi becomes second derivative is basically g phi. And the potential, which is dw d phi squared, becomes basically g squared phi star phi squared. So it's a phi to the fourth coupling, but whose coupling constant is related to the u phi coupling. So what supersymmetry is doing is it's relating the couplings of the bosons to the couplings of the fermions in a very specific way. And restricted to the masses, it becomes the statement of the masses are equal to each other. So you're supposed to notice that Suzy relates couplings and masses in particular. You can similarly do this with gauge fields. If you have some gauge fields, you know, A, alpha, mu, you can arrange for this to be epsilon bar gamma mu lambda alpha for some spin at half lambda. Delta lambda, I guess, would be gamma mu nu epsilon F alpha mu. That's other terms. So you can have supersymmetric gauge fields. So, for example, this thing is scattered transformed in the same way out of the gauge group, so that an invariant Lagrangian in this case would be minus 1/4 F alpha mu nu. F alpha mu nu minus 1/2 lambda bar alpha d slash lambda alpha. So, and this d slash is the gauge invariant, gauge covariant derivative for something which is in the same representation as A's are, so it's in the adjoint representation. D mu lambda alpha is partial mu lambda alpha, and then there's a up to numbers of C alpha beta gamma, you know, A beta mu lambda gamma. And there's some number I have in here. So again, the interactions of the gauge fields with themselves that are hidden in the F mu squareds are related to the interactions of the gauge fields with the spin half particles, which are hidden in here. And so supersymmetry is connecting the two different spins. Now your question comes up again. So what about closing things? You can kind of see that as I was doing these transformation rules, the thing that was appearing here differed depending what the interactions were. Right, so so when you're doing this, the way I'm presenting it to you, you have to construct the Lagrangian and the symmetry transformation rules at the same time, and that's a complication. If you don't know what the Lagrangians are, it's a complication in constructing. What you like to do is, in the standard model, you said, well, the most general thing I could possibly write down is this. And it's more difficult, the way I'm describing it, to do that for supersymmetry because the rules themselves are depending on what the Lagrangian is that you get. It's a variant of those rules. So you can finesse that by adding new fields. So you can add new fields which so that instead of having just phi and psi, you had a new field F, just another complex field. See, the problem was, the reason why there was a problem with these transformation rules was that although we arranged the particle states to be the same, so we had two particle states for the bosons and two for the fermions, what we didn't do was arrange the same number of fields, because there's four components to a spinner field, you know, four complex numbers, two complex numbers, and this is one complex number. And so to make the symmetry transformation of the fields close in a simple way, we need equal numbers of bosonic and fermionic fields, not particles. And the number of components to the fields differs with the spin, and so that it's not as straightforward. Having the same number of particles does not ensure that you have the same number of fields. So you sometimes have to add new fields called auxiliary fields, and they won't have it. So what will happen is that the kinetic terms won't be. The invariant term will now be psi bar d slash psi plus d phi star d phi plus f star f. So f won't have a kinetic term. It'll just be something you can, its equations of motion will be algebraic, and you can just solve them. And then the transformation rule will be delta psi left will be gamma mu epsilon right d mu phi plus f epsilon. And now the dimensions work, because f has dimensions of mass squared rather than mass. So that's why this has dimensions that's the same as this, even though there's no derivatives. And then when you solve the equation of motion for f, you find that f is equal to dw d phi. And so if you plug that back into the transformation rule, you'd be getting what I write down there all the time. But you can kind of see that the removal of f is what's introducing into the symmetry transformation rules a dependence on the Lagrangian. And so there's a complication in writing Lagrangian. Once you use these variables, then you can write down the most general thing that's supersymmetric once and for all, and then eliminate these f's once and for all and get the answer in a way which doesn't involve guessing it as you bootstrap yourself up. So that's so that's the main complication, I think, of the symmetry when you're thinking of using the symmetry. The main use is to know what's the most general Lagrangian you can write down. And I'm quoting answers because I know what the answer is, and it would have been hard to do this from scratch the way I'm telling it to you. So now we're at 12:30. So I'll pick up the story next time. Oh, we have an option as to when we start, because there's no colloquium. So if you want, we can start earlier. That's going to impinge on people that are traveling.
Is Werner going to be around?
Werner is around, and he says that if we call him early, he'll come early. Okay. But it's up to us, really. But then that probably doesn't help you guys, because your driver, I don't know if your driver's sitting here, right?
Well, no, he's supposed to come here at 5.
So he arrived at 5, I think.
Yeah. He's going to be pretty generated.
Okay. Yeah, you have to hang out. Okay, so then we
might. So we're free. We're okay with.
Yeah.
It helps you.
Well, what I'm thinking is that if we started at 3, then that gives us. We could finish a little bit earlier, and we could probably just finish the whole thing and then not have any classes next week.
Is there still a thing going on in here?